This is Ozarks at Large. When the Mississippi River flooded in 1927, it created one of the worst natural disasters in American history. Tom Franklin and Beth Ann Finley use the flood as a backdrop for their novel, Tilted World. Tom's past novels, like Crooked Letter, Crooked Letter, have achieved critical praise, including the Los Angeles Times Book Award. Beth's poetry has been published widely, including in 3 editions of the Best American Poetry. Both teach at the University of Mississippi, where Beth is the director of the university's MFA program. Both also receive their MFAs at the University of Arkansas. Tilted World takes readers inside a different era, when Prohibition was a boon to bootleggers, and people in rural Mississippi were just as likely to travel by foot or horse as car. Beth Ann Finley and Tom Franklin will read from their novel and sign copies at Nightbird Books in Fayetteville Friday night at 6:30. This month, Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellams reached them at their home in Oxford, Mississippi. Beth told Kyle that even though the flood of 1927 was devastating and changed the course of history, many people don't know about it.
Yeah, absolutely, Kyle. In fact, I had never heard of the flood till I moved to the South for the first time. I grew up in a suburb outside of Chicago. And when I moved to the South and learned about the flood, I was stunned that I had never heard about it before because the destruction was so unbelievable. 1 million people lost their houses. When the levee broke in outside of Greenville, Mississippi, and the water came through, it came through with twice the force of Niagara, and a wall of water 100 feet high scooped out the delta, yet I'd simply never heard of it. Probably there were several reasons. Most of the people affected were poor Southerners, both white and black, and also, it was in the politicians' best interest to kind of minimize and downplay the story of the flood devastation. So reading about the flood was really eye-opening for us.
And then to have the context, of course, of Prohibition and bootlegging, how much research did you have to do to make sure you got things right?
Well, Bethany, I did a lot of research, is the truth. She's the one who enjoys research in our duo, and I'm not. So she did a lot of great research on the flood and as well as Prohibition, World War One, all kinds of things. I'll let you talk there, Beth Ann. Go ahead.
Sure. Well, in truth, Kyle, the research was really fun because it's this great unimagined American story. It's not a story that has been told ad nauseum. So we did a whole bunch of different kinds of research. Reading the history books, of course, was great, and there's a famous and really useful and well-written book by John M. Barry called Rising Tide. It's a great nonfiction account of the flood. And reading the books by historians was really useful, but what was also really cool was when Tommy and I would drive down and research. We went to the place where the levee broke. We went to the Flood Museum in Greenville, and we did a lot of archival research, too. In particular, I got interested in letters and journals that women actually were keeping at the time, describing to their sister what they'd seen, because to read the statistic that 330,000 people were rescued from rooftops and barns is, of course, stunning, but it's so abstract, it's almost hard to get your head around. Meanwhile, we want to show the reader one person being rescued. So to have those women writing in their dialect and the time period from 1927 and describing what they saw was really useful, and the research was fascinating, but that, of course, was the danger. The research was so fascinating that there came a point where we just had to stop because doing more research wouldn't help us get the book written. Doing more research was another word for procrastination.
Well, I think of the quote attributed to Alfred Hitchcock when he says that it's far more interesting to know that there is a bomb under the table that might go off rather than just having this second where a bomb goes off. And that's kind of what we have in this book. If you know about the flood, you know it's coming, and so you tease us. And there's this sort of tension that grows as you go further in.
Well, good. If that happened, that's great, because that was one of the things we were going for.
Yeah, the flood's a good natural climactic event, and it did seem a good spot to aim for. We all didn't always know what was going to happen, but we knew that flood was coming, and we just would have to see how our people would respond to it when it, you know, when it did happen finally.
I have to ask about the how it worked, the physical work of writing a novel together. Tommy, you've written novels. Beth Ann, you're known for poetry. Did you submit to each other and revise? Did you write at the same time? And then, okay, an hour from now, we'll look at what each other has written?
Well, you know, there are two main characters, Dixie Clay and Ingersoll, man and woman. The original idea was for me to write Ingersoll, the man, and Beth Ann to write Dixie Clay, the woman. And that's how we started. And it would have been a good idea, except Beth Ann, the A student, finished her half before I, the B student, had even begun my half. So we just, you know, we were on different tracks a little bit. So, you know, when she had her half done, and she then began to wait for me to do my half, and of course I don't respond well to people waiting on me. And so we then talked and decided to work on my half together. So we wrote my half in Beth Ann's tiny office in the back of our house with our knees touching and just with both of our laptops back there. She called it dueling laptops. And that worked really well, and then the writing became far more interesting for both of us in that before it had just been writing the way writing always had been, you know, one person alone at his or her computer. But now it was two people in a room talking about what we were doing and even writing sentences together, you know, finishing one another's sentences as we worked. So that's when it really became, you know, a much truer collaboration than it had been at first.
So can you, when you go back and read this, can you see each other's voices in it? Because I had no idea that that might be a Franklin sentence or that might be a Fenley sentence.
Well, the truth is most of them are Fenley sentences. I mean, she wrote about 75% of the book if we do the math. So I think that's part of it, but part of it, you know, is an answer Beth Ann gave that I really liked to a question similar a few months ago, and it was this, that we have been reading each other's stuff for almost 20 years now. We've been each other's first best reader for, you know, half Beth Ann's life and, you know, a good part of my life. So in a way, we've been collaborating for years, and every novel that I've written, Beth Ann has been intricate to that novel. She would have read it in very early drafts. She would have talked about the ideas with me. She would have edited it extensively and, you know, again, just talked more and listened and asked questions. She's literally the best editor I've ever worked with, and I've had now, you know, a number of editors. So, you know, I've really benefited from that, I think, you know, with every book. And so coming to this new one, you know, where we're working on it together, it just seemed like a natural step in the evolution, you know, of us as writers.
Yeah, I think that's true, and I do think it's a compliment when our friends who have read both of our separate writings say, oh, I was reading your novel, and I was looking for the seams and trying to listen for the voice change when one of you stopped writing, the other started, and I couldn't find the seams. And I do really think that that's a lovely thing to say, and in a way it's surprising, but in a way it's not, because we did meet 19 years ago there in Kimball Hall at the University of Arkansas, where we'd both come to study writing. And from that day to today, there's hardly a day gone by where we haven't either been exchanging our own words or talking about books we love or, you know, talking about student work together that we've both been reading, and always this idea of maybe our voices growing closer or at least understanding each other's voices led to this moment that we didn't even know we were preparing for.
Were there conversations, sort of analytical conversations, about how to set a scene? The book opens with this wonderfully cinematic scene when this orphaned child is found by these agents, and we go from there. I mean, would you talk about certain words or turns of phrases, or did it just flow?
Well, all of it. I mean, sometimes it didn't just flow, you know. Sometimes it was agony. And sometimes it came pretty easily, and sometimes we would just get to a little hitch, and we wouldn't know what would happen next, and it was really frustrating. We'd have to talk our way through it, maybe try a couple wrong moves, and then steer ourselves over to the right one somehow. And you know, now that it's done, we look back, and it all seems so foreordained and destined. But
yeah.
There were lots of really confusing moments during the whole time. We just tend to forget about them now because they were so painful.
But what's also interesting is that, you know, those confusing moments were less irksome because there were two of us to work them out, as opposed to there just being one person to work them out. You know, if it had been me alone or Beth Ann alone, you know, and we might have helped each other, but the help could only be go to a certain extent. You know, this help went far deeper in than it otherwise would have, because we're, you know, because it's the same project, we have the same goal in mind.
It feels, when I read it, of course, it's something that happened more than 80 years ago, and it does feel as if it's a completely different world. Of course, I didn't grow up in Mississippi. Am I right in feeling that there's this otherworldliness about what's happening around the town of Hobnob, Mississippi, in the Tilted World?
Yeah, I think so. You know, 1927 was such a fascinating year, and we really wanted to do justice to the fact that it was a year in which the world changed, and I mean that quite literally. At the end of the year, one out of five people in America had a car. That was the year people got electricity. That was the year, because people got cars, hotels started being built, which meant people started having sex outside of marriage, and so condom sales started increasing, and the per capita income of Americans went up, and it was the year where women started showing their knees, for example. I mean, just think about a year in which women show their knees for the first time and how that's going to change American culture. So we really wanted to, you know, create this world where all the old way was making a big turn, and to put into this prohibition, which was really interesting for the kind of extreme behaviors it elicited, it just seemed like a really ripe place to set a novel, and the flood, of course, the natural climax.
Dixie is a wonderful character, and the fact that you mentioned prohibition, she's such a good bootlegger and smarter than just about, or is smarter, really, than anybody else about her. I can imagine she was a fun, interesting character to develop.
Yeah, she was. We had a lot of fun with her. And, you know, in order to do research about how she was such a good bootlegger, of course, Tommy and I were forced to taste a glass or two during the writing of the novel.
A glass or two of you know, stuff created by, say, non-professionals?
Yes. But you didn't hear that from us.
Okay.
Right.
And how is it?
Delicious.
Well, some of it is not so good, but we actually did find some that is pretty delicious. We found a guy who makes apple pie moonshine, and we ended up having him make a batch for our book release party.
Tom, I want to ask you about writing dialogue, because in Crooked Letter, it was great. In this book, it's fantastic. I think that writing dialogue has to be one of the most difficult things, because you want to get it right. You want to set it in a period. You want to set it in a place so it sounds genuine, but you don't want to go too far. How do you know when you've got just the right dialogue going?
Well, you know, for me, it's just a matter of feel. It's a matter of using dialect a lot less than more. You know, a little bit of dialect goes a long way. So I try not to use that a lot. And hopefully just the rhythms of, you know, of the character's speech will come through. And, you know, and one thing that helps it are the expressions that people use in the country. Those are always fun. And people do use those. So, you know, we try to put a few of those in here and there. And really, it's just simply a matter of making each character sound a little bit different from the other. You know, so with Crooked Letter, I'm working with, you know, the African-American dialect and, you know, and even a Chicago accent at one point. And then just, you know, the regular white guy's dialect and the white women's dialect. So simply a matter of, you know, for me, it's been a lifetime of listening. I grew up in Alabama and grew up listening to the difference between white people and black people, the way they talk, and there are differences. And there are differences, of course, between the way Alabamians and Arkansans talk. So just trying to get all those little, just try to get it all right. I remember listening to William Gay talk once, and he mentioned, you know, a chap. And in Tennessee, they call, you know, young toddlers chaps, which I'd never heard. So that will be true to that area. So, you know, just trying to be true to whatever area that we're writing about.
I have to admit, I had never heard or read the word diddy referring to a diaper.
Yeah, I think actually it was pronounced Didi.
Didi. Ah, that makes sense.
Yeah, but it was a country word in the south part of Mississippi. And you know, we learned a couple, like I said, just from reading those initial texts, with things like William Anders Out Percy's discussion of living in Greenville during the flood, but that, for example, that they called a front porch a gallery, you know, was new to us as well, but it was so uniform and such a commonly used word at the time that we decided to use it and just assume that the reader could figure out what we were talking about.
And there's another example that I like that Beth Ann found. I was reading a chapter she had written, and Ham Johnson was talking about handcuffs, and he called them bracelets. I thought, that's great. And she's read that somewhere, that someone did refer to handcuffs as bracelets. So, you know, so all that kind of research really does pay off, you know, and those little words find their way in. And each example of that bolsters the novel in a tiny way, which, you know, works, you know, when they all add up, it hopefully works well.
Finally, did your experience as parents help you, because you're writing about this very young human being who is found early and part of the story, and making sure the junior is fed and his dieties are taken care of? Did you flash back to some of your parenting?
Well, we ended up doing a little bit more than flashing back. Say, during the course of the novel, you know, this novel took us almost 4 years to write, which when you think that there were two of us, that's like 8 years. That's pretty pathetic. But in addition to having to figure out how to collaborate, which was a new thing, we were slowed down by this one little hiccup, which is to say, we took this very romantic anniversary trip to the south of France, and you know, we drank all this wine. It was so beautiful. And we came home, and I had, you know, some type of crazy bug. I've had food poisoning. It wouldn't go away. It wouldn't go away. It wouldn't go away. Turns out it was a baby. So our children are now 12, 8, and 2. And that 2-year-old, you know, came along and really, as you can imagine, ended up changing things a bit in our little household. But I would say, you know, there were so many unexpected pleasures about this unexpected child. And even in writing the novel, there was this giant joy in being a mom and being able to look at my baby and have that be part of my work in a way. There's always this terrible feeling you have to turn your gaze away, rip your gaze away, really, to focus on your work. And here was a time when Dixie Clay, you know, had a baby, and I was playing with my baby, and I decided at one point to freeze the baby in the novel, Willie, at 7 months, because my baby was 7 months, and just describe everything about him. And you know, it was so fun to be able to bring him into our novel in that way.
Tom Franklin and Beth Ann Finley are the authors of the novel Tilted World, and teach at the University of Mississippi. They'll read from and sign copies of their book Friday night at 6:30 at Nightbird Books on Dixon Street in Fayetteville. They spoke with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums earlier this month.